The cost of NATO, the cost of getting rid of the estate tax, and the real cost of coal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, January 16th. Happy Martin Luther King Day, and thank you for joining us. In interviews with European newspapers over the weekend, President-elect Donald Trump criticized NATO. He said the military alliance is important to him, but he called it outdated and, quote, obsolete. He says it is too divorced from the fight against terrorism. As you might imagine, not all experts see it that way. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has more.
When Trump criticized NATO, he pointed out that it was designed many, many years ago. But Jeremy Shapiro of the European Council on Foreign Relations says that doesn't mean it hasn't fought against terrorism.
It wasn't very many years ago that the United States called upon NATO to respond to the 9/11 attack, that NATO was the principal instrument that the United States used to fight the war in Afghanistan.
Still, Shapiro says Trump seems to misunderstand NATO's mission.
NATO is a military organization, and military organizations are not centrally focused on terrorism, nor should they be.
Heather Conley says she understands Trump's concern. She's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says only 5 of the 28 NATO allies, including the U.S., devote more than 2% of their GDP to defense spending. But a few years ago, NATO leaders said they'd step up.
Can they do more? Yes. Can they spend more? Yes. But the trajectory is in the right place.
For a while now, U.S. leaders have been calling on European countries to pay their fair share, says Christopher Preble at the Cato Institute.
And so I think that there's going to be a push under the Trump administration to try to get more European allies to contribute more, not merely to their own defense, but also to military capabilities that could be useful throughout the alliance as a whole.
But some experts, like Shapiro, worry how Trump's overall negative tone toward NATO will impact relations. He says America's alliances
are the sort of central pillar of American strength in the world.
And if they erode, they'll be difficult to reconstruct. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Sticking with policy for a moment, getting rid of the estate tax has been a priority of the Republican Party for years. Trump's transition team has said his administration would aim to roll back the tax as part of a larger package of tax cuts. We look at how likely that repeal really is and what it might mean for the federal deficit. Marketplace's Mariel Seguera's got that one.
When people die with more than $5.5 million, whoever inherits that money has to pay a federal tax of up to 40%. You're probably going to hear a lot of talk about repealing that tax over the next few months. Eric Toder is co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
It would cost over the 10-year period roughly $175 billion in lost revenues.
That may seem like a lot, but annually, the estate tax brings in less than 1% of federal tax revenues, limiting its effect, Toder says, on the federal fiscal balance sheet.
The estate tax on its own is not that big a deal as far as the deficit is concerned.
Bill Hoagland from the Bipartisan Policy Center says the debate over cutting the estate tax won't come down to a question of lost revenue.
It's going to be argued out on the basis of equity and fairness.
What's fair depends on who you talk to. On the one hand, Hoagland says, the tax is intended to address income inequality and provide some redistribution of wealth.
We don't want our large Rockefellers and other type families growing to control such a large amount of the country's wealth.
Joe Duran, CEO of United Capital, says other people think it's unfair to pay taxes your whole life and then have that money taxed again when you die.
That's just not American. It basically says you're renting your wealth, and then the government's going to take it from you.
That's the case Trump will likely be making when he argues in favor of a repeal. In New York, I'm Mariel Seguera for Marketplace.
And whatever the campaign promises about bringing back coal jobs, the prospects for that industry just don't look great. Fracking and natural gas are too competitive an energy source for coal to return to its glory days. There are still some areas where coal is so cheap that it holds its own, but a recent development could make even those spots less viable. Marketplace sustainability reporter Jed Kim explains.
In 2015, more than 40% of the coal produced in the U.S. came from publicly owned lands. The federal coal program that manages the leases for those lands hasn't been updated for more than 30 years. Connie Wilbert is with the Sierra Club. She says companies have been paying way too little for the coal they mine.
It's kind of flies in the face of this whole free market philosophy. Why would we allow these giant international corporations to get such a bargain?
The Bureau of Land Management is updating the program, and among the possible changes released last week are higher royalties and mitigation costs for climate impacts. John Morgan is with Respec, a coal consultant. He says such a change wouldn't be a nail in the coffin for the industry, just more of a jostling.
It is relatively less expensive than other coal fields, and that's why it's got the market share that it does.
Even so, Andrew Cosgrove, Bloomberg Intelligence energy analyst, says it's iffy whether higher royalties would actually be adopted.
These are just recommendations. I would imagine that there would be a lot of pushback from the coal companies and say, you know, we already went through a pretty nasty decline.
Robert Godby teaches at the University of Wyoming. He says one real impact the BLM recommendations will have is that its findings can now be considered in future lawsuits.
This was a report prepared by the government agency, and so it's very difficult to ignore that sort of information.
One of the Obama administration's final acts has given fuel in future fights over coal. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets are closed in observance of Martin Luther King Day, but in European trading, two companies were having great days. Luxottica, the world's largest glasses and sunglasses maker, think Ray-Ban, will merge with the world's biggest lens manufacturer, Essilor. That deal is worth about $49 billion and a very big chunk of the $100 billion a year eyewear market. More on the day's financial happenings when we do the numbers. Depending on who you ask, the arrival of fifth-generation wireless networks, or 5G, will either usher in a totally new era of connected technologies or take forever to arrive and usher in slightly faster internet to phones and other mobile devices. At CES, the huge technology trade show in Las Vegas earlier this month, the mood about 5G was good. Mobile chipmaker Qualcomm was among the companies making announcements related to 5G, and so while I was there, I sat down with Qualcomm CEO Steve Mollenkopf, and I asked him why 5G could mean so much more than just faster internet on your phone.
Well, I think if you look, there's this trend that's going on, which is every industry is being disrupted because it's being connected to the internet. And increasingly, the majority of those connections are wireless. And we can do a lot with 4G, we can do a lot with Wi-Fi, but we really want to be able to sweep in as many new industries as we can to take advantage of getting connected to the internet. 5G is really about that. It's about what do we need to do to enable cellular to not only advance the mobile ecosystem, but all these other ecosystems that want to take advantage of what's happening with mobile. And that's happening with 5G, and it's accelerating, and it's becoming, I think, a very exciting time for the industry as a result.
You talked about the possibility that 5G would usher in this sort of new era for inventors. Do you have a sense of what kind of businesses and services could potentially be built on top of this technology and why it's so powerful?
Well, the interesting thing is, no, we don't, actually. Now, you're seeing early examples of this happening in the car. I mean, the car today, it's all about the brain in the car, not so much about the brawn. Everyone wants to have autonomous cars. They're all going to be connected. It's going to change the way, really, we drive, the way transportation is going to be optimized, and it's going to be much safer. It's going to be much better. Healthcare, another great example. It's just at the early days of taking advantage of what's going to happen when people get connected and their health is able to be not only administered to when they're in the doctor's office, but every day. And it's really going to be pretty exciting. That's just two examples. But what's interesting is 10 years from now, somebody's going to come up with a use case that we've never thought of. And our job is to create the technology underlying that that enables them to be successful.
You also announced a new mobile processor, new chip here at the show. And I want to dive into the world of chips a little bit. Tell us about that new chip, but also other ones that you're building. Like, where is Qualcomm? You know, in the universe of the electronics that I interact in every day, how many times do I touch something from Qualcomm?
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult to go through your day without touching a Qualcomm product. In fact, most people that are listening to us right now, I would imagine they probably have a Qualcomm chip in their pocket, or they're not very far away from a Qualcomm chip in some way. They're certainly not very far away from a Qualcomm invention, for sure. Now, what's happening today, what we're doing is we're now spreading that out, not just from the handset market, But our chips are now in cars. Our chips are now in the Internet of Things. We've shipped just hundreds of millions of devices that go into products that you wouldn't expect have connectivity in them, but they do.
Interesting. And that leads to my next question, which is, how hard are these to build and manufacture? What kind of specialization is required? Like, could anybody just get into the chip business with the right, you know, presses?
Well, it's difficult. The chips that people make today, they're incredibly complex and expensive to make, much more than multiple times a large blockbuster movie. And in fact, I think if you were to look at them, you would almost argue they would kind of be the modern version of the pyramids. I mean, they're just incredible human, achievements. But it can be, if you don't know how to manage all that complexity across multiple disciplines, it can be difficult to stay in it.
Where do you see all these different kinds of chips ending up in the future? Like you talked about how they're going to be in cars, and I assume they're going to be in air conditioners. And, yep. You know, so how far do you see your potential Qualcomm universe extending?
Well, I think almost every electronics device is going to be connected to the Internet. And so that's an opportunity for us. We also think people are going to be wearing many more devices that that have chips in them that are connected to the cloud. And then there are people who view that eventually you're going to have chips in the body that are going to do certain things. And we're certainly of that view as well. And so I think it's really an interesting time to be in the chip industry, just because the funnel is expanding so much in terms of what the applications of the devices.
Steve Mollenkopf, Qualcomm CEO. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tomorrow, many of you will be headed back to work after a three-day weekend. You might be feeling a little sluggish, a little unproductive. Maybe that's every day. Well, Silicon Valley is trying to fix that brain fog. Nootropics are the hot new category of brain-enhancing substances. Plenty of people, including scientists, question the idea of these little pep pills. But here in the Valley, where it is work at all costs, there are also plenty of true believers. Sam Harnett reports.
Like many who take nootropics, Daniel Wiggins works in tech.
It started about 9 months ago when I was working on my own startup, you know, classic San Francisco.
Wiggins is at a weekly biohacker meetup in a San Francisco cafe. In pursuit of productivity, biohackers do things like shock their brains with low voltages of electricity and experiment with prescription drugs. At the peak of his biohacking, Wiggins was drinking Soylent instead of eating. It's supposedly a meal in a bottle.
I was trying to figure out, how do I get, you know, sort of 10, 12, 14, 16 hours of productivity per day?
That's a lot of productive hours. Not everyone drinks Soylent at the meetup, but they all take nootropic pills. You, too, probably have a nootropic every day. Caffeine. Can't work without it. The word nootropic refers to substances some believe improve cognitive function, like caffeine, but also all kinds of other things. Compounds made in labs, herbs used in Chinese medicine. Nootropics companies mix these different substances together into pills. Wiggins takes one made by a San Francisco company called Nutrabox, which is co-founded by Stanford University graduate Michael Brandt.
So a big part of what we're trying to do in the larger sense is to rebrand work as something very fulfilling, something very exciting, so a means of self-actualization.
Not that thing we all have to do to pay rent and eat. Most of Nutrabox's customers are in the Bay Area. Brandt describes nootropics as performance enhancers for white-collar workers. UC Berkeley nutritional scientist Mark Hellerstein doesn't believe they're effective.
There is almost never a proper study that anyone in real medicine would accept as showing efficacy or benefit in human beings.
Most nootropics are sold as supplements, which aren't tested and reviewed by the FDA the same way as drugs. Nootropics enthusiasts swap studies and tips online, but Hellerstein and others in his field aren't impressed.
All you got to do is make a claim, read a few rat studies, and you can market stuff on shelves and make a lot of money.
Nutrabox has a couple $1 million in funding from Silicon Valley regulars like Mark Andreessen. But other companies are just getting started, like Nutru. It was founded by aspiring tech entrepreneur Eric Matzner.
So if you hear birds, that means that I'm calm.
Don't try to control it or change it.
your distractions as they come and go.
Metzner has on a heart rate monitor and a brainwave monitor. He's showing me the meditation he did to calm down for this interview.
For this session, try to be fully awake and aware of any moment where the practice starts to feel challenging or frustrating.
Metzner sells two pills. His hope is that they'll make people more productive.
So here's one I keep in a necklace around my neck. Here's one with gold flakes and one with silver flakes.
Back at the biohacker meetup, Wiggins tells me that he's scaled back. He no longer drinks all his meals, but he still takes nootropics every day.
I think, you know, sustainable for me is sleep, exercise, nutrition, intermittent fasting, and a small amount of nootropics.
When it comes to productivity for Wiggins, regular old cup of coffee just doesn't cut it anymore. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Coming up, like, I would do anything. Sell my soul. I don't know, just for a few hours of sleep. That is the sound of a woman who's ready to shell out some serious cash. The business of putting baby to sleep. But first, let's do the numbers. The major U.S. markets are closed today for Martin Luther King Day. Overseas, European markets were mostly down. It was another bad day for Samsung. Prosecutors in South Korea are calling for the arrest of the company's heir apparent, J.Y. Lee. They have linked him to a corruption scandal involving that country's now impeached president. 43% of U.S. businesses observed Martin Luther King Day as a paid holiday today. That's a new record, according to a survey from Bloomberg BNA. Currently the least observed national holiday, that would be Columbus Day in October. Only 16% of employers now give that as a paid day off. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The Brazilian government is defending its controversial dam building program in the Amazon. Hundreds of hydroelectric dams already exist or are planned along the river basin. Brazil says they will boost the economy and provide clean energy. Environmentalists say the dams are a disaster. The BBC's Brazil correspondent, Weira Davies, visited Brazil's first mega dam project called Belo Monte and spent time with indigenous communities whose lands and villages stand in its path.
Rising out of the world's greatest rainforest, a huge concrete monolithic monument to progress. The Belo Monte hydroelectric dam is the fourth largest in the world and cost about $18 billion to build. It's been mired in allegations of corruption and has created a huge lake, radically altering the course and flow of one of the biggest rivers in the Amazon, the Xingu. Building the dam brought hundreds of jobs to the riverside town of Altamira, but it also led to increasing deforestation and the permanent loss of many low-lying river islands. Supporters of hydropower admit mistakes were made, but they say the rivers and their energy are there to be harnessed for the greater good of Brazil. Next in line for development is the Tapajós, described as the most beautiful river in the Amazon region and home to the Mundurucú indigenous people. A plan to build several dams along its length would transform this wide, shallow river into a navigable water highway. But it would flood forests and islands used by the Mundurucú for centuries. Touring the Mundurucú's territory, tribal chief Cacique Juarez Mundurucú showed me how technology is helping the tribe. GPS mapping, helping to prove that any dam built here would permanently flood land legally belonging to the tribe.
I've seen these so-called developments, the dams and the barrages. They don't bring any benefits to the people. That's why we are against them. There's not one place where a dam has been built that has turned out good for locals and for our tribes. there's only misery and complaints.
É só reclamação.
Sometimes described as a clean energy, environmental campaigners like Lisa Gunn say hydropower, especially in the Amazon, is anything but. The construction process is destructive, and flooded forests produce tons of greenhouse gases. She argues that a hot and windy country like Brazil should be investing in other alternatives.
We are not choosing between hydroelectric and oil. We are choosing between hydroelectric and solar energy. We need the standing forest for the sake of the forest people, but also for the climate, the global climate. And I think that the idea is that we do not need to destroy here in order to have energy for Brazilian development.
The painted and tattooed men and women of the Mundurucu have a fearsome reputation for defending their land, but they're taking on powerful business and political interests. Proposals are already being debated in the Brazilian Congress that would weaken existing environmental laws and slash funding for forest protection.
That's the BBC's Wira Davies. Earlier in the program, we told you about products designed to help wake up your brain. Now let's talk about products that aim to help with sleep. Baby sleep, actually, an acute issue for anyone who has ever lived with a newborn. The wholesale infant sleep industry is worth more than $325 million a year, and some of those sleep products also claim to keep your baby safe. From Kaiser Health News, Jenny Gold has this story from Oakland, California.
Lindsay Barrick and her husband have been trying to get baby Arlo to sleep for almost an hour.
He sounds so miserable.
You're so sad.
I know. If you just would go to sleep, you'd feel better.
It would definitely make his parents feel better. Since Arlo was born 3 months ago, they haven't been getting much sleep. So far, they've spent about $250 on things like an $80 vibrating bassinet and swaddling blankets to help.
I mean, I sort of feel like I would do anything. Sell my soul. I don't know, just for a few hours of sleep.
Companies that make the products know parents aren't just losing sleep because their babies are crying. It's also because they're worried about protecting their infants from sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. To stay safe, babies are supposed to sleep on their backs. So a new smart bassinet called a Snoo that advertises itself as the safest baby bed ever made is designed to keep babies from rolling over. The marketing materials don't mention SIDS specifically, but the bassinet's inventor, Dr. Harvey Karp, says safety is one of the Snoo's biggest selling points.
A lot of people find the value proposition just in knowing that their baby can't roll to a dangerous position. You put your baby in, you have peace of mind, you don't have to check your baby. That's like insurance. So that's worth the price of admission.
The price of admission for the Snoo is $1,160. Karp is the author of The Happiest Baby on the Block, where he offers tips on helping babies to sleep. The Snoo responds automatically to soothe the baby's cries.
This bed will move all night long, gently rocking the baby back and forth, making white noise that's like the sound of rain on the roof.
The FDA says the makers of a broad range of products claim that they reduce the risk of SIDS, baby monitors, infant positioners, mattresses. The American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't evaluate individual products on the market, but it discourages buying any product that claims to reduce the risk of SIDS.
Because there's no evidence that any of these products that are marketed as such to reduce the risk of SIDS actually do that.
That's Dr. Lori Feldman-Winter, who is a co-author of the Academy's latest recommendations on safe sleep. She says the things that actually keep a baby safe are cheap or even free. Put the baby's bed in the parent's room for the first year. Place a baby on its back. Breastfeed. And when it comes to a bed, she says less is more.
A cardboard box that has a firm mattress, that has a tightly fitted sheet with no other objects, may be perfect for a baby.
Back in Oakland, Lindsay and her husband are doing their best to follow all of the recommendations and just to enjoy being parents, despite the sleeplessness.
When he wakes up from his nap and he has just like the cutest smile on his face, we're like, okay, I guess it's all it's all worth the exhaustion and the frustration.
And the good news, they may get some relief soon. Most babies are able to sleep through the night by about 6 months. I'm Jenny Gold for Marketplace and Kaiser Health News.
And this final note before we go comes to us from a tweet. Charlie Bellillo is a mutual fund manager at Pension Partners. Over the weekend, he tweeted a chart showing returns from two, quote, revolutionary companies that went public in 2004. One was Google, now Alphabet. Over the next 12 years, it returned 1,555% of its initial share price. Bananas, am I right? But the second company did even better. Its returns were 2,401%. So what is that company, you ask? Domino's Pizza. Now just Domino's. Because, yeah, we like the internet and whatever, but this is America we're talking about here. Pass the pepperoni. Markets were closed today in observance of Martin Luther King Day. Our daily production team here at Marketplace includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood. We are back here again tomorrow. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.